Welcome back to First Edition. I'm your host, Catalina Bird, sitting in for my dear friend Sean Yost. And again, please make sure you're following us on Twitter at FirstEdition889 and like our face and follow our Facebook First Edition page, as well as following the real host of this show at Sean Yost on Facebook and Twitter as well. He has insightful and breaking news, and he will share the things that you allow him to. And later on this hour, we'll speak with Lamar Darnell Shields, senior change agent for the Cameo Group and founder of Praise College Readiness Program for his phase and fellowship tour. But first, we're joined in studio by author Black Diamond. She's the author of a series of three books that are very important, and I'm glad we're having this conversation. One named She Named Me Stacy, another called A Temporary Home for Stacy, and Stacy F., My Forever Mommy, which is a great way to explain adoption to kids and for the whole family to enjoy. This Saturday is National Adoption Day, and we are glad that Ms. Diamond can share her experience having raised 9 children. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We were talking just as we met, you know, while we were not on air yet, about how many of our children are in this system and we don't go back and get them. What made you want to adopt? What was the very first thing that struck this chord in you?
I started not as an adoptive parent or a foster parent. It was what they consider a relative resource when my niece came into my life. I was a teen parent and didn't realize that I was a teen parent. I guess the good thing about that was I didn't have to go through the labor pains, but that was the easy way.
Yeah, absolutely, correct.
I had her and I was taking care of her, but I was afraid at the same time because I was 17 years of age. I think that at the time you had to be 21. So, of course, I didn't exactly tell the truth about my age, but I didn't want her to go into care. And I wanted them to know that she could be cared for, so I did what I felt like I had to do in order for my niece not to go into care. And I was raising her, and I wound up raising 2 other relatives' children at the same time. And that's what started my journey with taking in relatives' children, and that's who I have. And now I have 9 altogether.
It's so funny you say that, because my very first job out of high school, I was a state employee, and I got placed at the Department of Social Service over on East Biddle Street. And it is where kinship care, yes, as they call it, is we process the money you get for them as a family member. But it was also where children who had been removed had supervised visits with parents. And I had to go. I didn't make it a whole month because the little babies didn't understand. And to hear them down the hall crying, asking why they can't go home, and then to see the anger and the pain in the teenagers who are in a group home or some stranger's home because there wasn't a relative that they could go to that could pass the requirements. I just internalized it too much, and I asked for a transfer, and I went to the public defender's office. I couldn't even handle it. But there's so many children of color, our children, that we don't go back and get, and they don't have relatives like you that can pass the requirements to get them. And so I didn't know there was a National Adoption Day. On Saturday, what is some things that people who have homes and want to help children can do?
Well, they can contact their local Department of Social Services to let them know if they have relatives that's in care. They can contact them and let them know that they believe that they have a relative that could possibly be in the system, is what they call it, in care. And they will take the information and they will investigate it. And if it's found that they do have a relative, they will contact them and let them know what they would need to do if they choose to become that relative resource for them. Like in the book, you were just saying how difficult it was for some of the children to not, they don't understand the situation.
Right.
And that's where She Named Me Stacy came from. My nephew at the time, he was my nephew, he's my son now. And he had asked why was he in care, and he was 11. And I thought that they explained it to him of why he was in care and why he came to me. So I sat and I explained it to him, and I was praying at the same time that I hope I'm doing him some justice and I can give him the answers that he would need. And
right.
When I finished, I asked him, I said, "You okay?" And he said, "Yes." And I'm saying to myself, "Am I okay?" Because I was really afraid to explain to him why I felt like he was in care and what was told to me. And he wound up saying he was okay. And I went to look, and I saw his younger sister sitting there. I said, oh, God, give me strength. I'm going to have to tell her the same thing. But her journey was different than his. And each child that comes into care, their journey is different. So I decided to write it down. Mm-hmm. And as I was writing, I said, this could become a book, but will she understand it? Yeah. Shoot, I'm a caseworker, and sometimes I don't understand it.
Oh, you
but
a
what
caseworker
about?
Too?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you God, God put all kinds of callings on your life. I couldn't do it.
Sometimes it became hard, you know, for parents to understand the process of it. So to write it down for children to understand the journey and why they're in care and why they're not living with mommy, or maybe they have a friend that looks a little different than their family and they want to know, well, mommy, my friend don't look like their family. And the mother may tell them that they're in foster care, but this book will help them understand. And to give it to Stacy, which is who I have the real Stacy.
Right.
And she understands her journey now. Stacy is under 10, and she understands her journey. She also has a brother who is 4. So we will be reading this story to him and telling him his journey as well. So we will continue to explain the journey. And for individuals who are parents, prospective parents who are thinking about adoption, we can also do the same thing with She Named Me Stacy, for them to be able to understand the process. And that's just the beginning of the process.
Okay, so now a temporary home for Stacy. You said She Named Me Stacy begins the explanation of the process. A temporary home for Stacy. Can you tell us some about what the second book is about?
Yes, the second book is the temporary home that's foster care. And foster care is and was built for it to be just a temporary placement. And I don't really like using the word placement, but so many people are used to the word. We say journey because that's what they're on. They're on a journey, their journey. Mm-hmm. And it begins the journey of Stacy, as well as the journey for the foster parent who has Stacy in a home on a temporary basis until either Stacy can go back home to her biological family or they find a forever family for Stacy. So Stacy learns so many different things, her transition from foster care to adoption. It becomes an affirmation for permanency, as she realized that the hardest lessons in life is letting go and loving unconditionally. And that's what happens when she's in a temporary home.
And so you're a caseworker in Howard County?
No.
Not in Howard County? They said you were acknowledged for your work. Oh, but the lifelong literacy. Okay. I'm sorry, I misread that. But you went to school here at Morgan.
Yes, I am a bear. Yes, I am. I'm always going to be a bear. I am from the first graduating class of the School of Social Work here at Morgan.
That is so amazing. That is so, and such a testament to what we do here. And we've been having conversations about our journalism school, but we have great schools outside of journalism that are creating passionate and competent people in their various fields like yourself that then turn around and see. So many people talk about what's not available, but very few take the next step to create what they know is not there. And the fact that you knew that you needed this for your own family and then thought beyond yourself and said, these books aren't out here and they don't look like us, and I'm just going to make it happen. I'll write the book. I'm living this journey, as you put it. It's so powerful because other people would not have done that.
Thank you. When you know, I was a student here at Morgan, one of the things that they told us was to think outside of the box. And being a caseworker, you're thinking outside of the box every day. We wear so many different hats. Just being in this field, that we are the doctor, we are the judge, we are the fireman, we are the police. So we just work in so many different aspects of the life of a child. As in the story with Stacy F., My Forever Mommy, Stacy learns the difference between having a biological mother, foster mother, and an adoptive mother. She does learn that all along she had all three, a mom, and a mommy. So it's told in the story that a biological mother gives birth to you and they love you unconditionally and sometimes have to make hard decisions. She also learns that a foster mother makes a choice. They love you and will take care of you temporarily. But then there's that adoptive mother who chooses you. So that makes you special right there. And they love you and want to be your forever family. And with my Stacy, she does have a biological mother, but she does have that. She still has that relationship with the person who was her temporary mother, and that's her foster mother. But she has me now as her mother as well, and I'm her forever mommy. So she did learn that, and that's the message that I want to give to other children that's like Stacy, that they will soon someday have a forever family as well.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition on WEAA 88.9. I am Catalina Bird, sitting in for Sean Yost, and we're having awesome conversation with author Black Diamond about her three-book series, which addresses adoption and explains it to the children going through this process. Have you, in your work, as the word gets out about these books, are you finding parents asking you to write something for adults who are going through this process to kind of bridge that gap between the temporary mom and the biological mom and the forever mom? Is that maybe a next set of books that you will write, the companion for the children, for the adults? Because like you said, this sparked from you getting asked the question and you being afraid yourself as to what you were going to say. Is that something that you foresee?
Yes, it is. I'm planning on telling my journey, the ups and the downs, because in every aspect of being a foster parent, there are ups and there are downs. I will let them know about my journey and what I had to go through to even find Stacy, because Stacy wasn't a relative that I knew about. She was someone that I had to find. So that was a hard find, but it was the best find that I could ever have, which was finding Stacy and her siblings. Stacy is number 13 or 14 of her siblings, and I have five of them. And to find Stacy and to have her with my family, with her immediate family, because she wasn't always with us, is that joy that I have, knowing that she's being raised with the rest of us. I will continue to advocate for her and advocate for children like Stacy, and advocate for the families who are wishing that they could become foster parents or adoptive parents, and let them know that at the end of the day, it's about the kids. And that's what sets, I think, being a worker separate and different from everything else, is that it's about the kids.
The number is 410-319-8888 if you'd like to call and ask questions of the author. Donna, you're calling from Baltimore. Good evening and welcome to First Edition. Donna? Okie dokie. Donna, you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. How are you?
Okay, how you doing? And excellent show. I had a question for your guest. We do have mothers, single mothers, who cannot really take care of their children. And they, you know, because they have a lot of emotional and mental health issues themselves. And I know the Department of Social Service does everything to keep the family together, you know, keep the mother with the children. But what could we tell our mothers, especially our young mothers, who really, you know, have two and three and four children, who really cannot, you know, emotionally and financially take care of their children? How do we encourage these mothers to get us, you know, maybe a surrogate family to help her raise her children, or encourage her to put them in a healthier home? Adoption home where a family can actually take care of them, because she's suffering from, you know, issues of mental illness and whatever. Because I see a lot of, I have people and a friend who deal with the social service system, and they work so hard to try to keep the mother stable, but the children are still suffering in that home because mom is not, you know, mom has emotional and mental and health care issues. It's interesting to see this balance that they're trying to keep, but then the children still don't get the attention the attention they should get, you know, in a home where there's, emotional and mental health issues with the mom. And I wanted, you know, your guests to, elaborate on that, because, it's very disturbing to see these children want the mother to be healthy and you know what, but there are a lot of times the social service, you know, they're kind of like at a catch-22 situation where they're focusing on the mother so much that the children are not getting the care and the service they really need to get. Now hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you. It is in some way a catch-22. There is programs that some local departments have. One that I know of is family preservation, where they try to preserve the family and keep the family together. And then they have wraparound services that they also offer a lot of the families. Mental health is also a key component of that service as well. But I guess for me, I'm old school. I go back to, it does take that village, and I introduce every family that comes to me to speak to me about She Named Me Stacy or any of the books that I have, and I talk to them about that journey and that village, and I introduce them to my village, and that's the mental health providers, because I use those, and I use the providers even for myself when I feel as though I need that break. And I can go to them because I said, this is me, and these are my foster children, my adopted children. Could I imagine what the parent may go through on a regular basis? So I utilize that. I get involved with so many different systems that I make my family, and that's what we're teaching a lot of the families, how you can make your family. When they say blended, they're not just talking about the stepfather,
that had children from a previous marriage.
Right. We're talking about blended families. Are the teachers in schools, are your churches. You have to get them involved in every aspect of it. It's not about them being nosy. It's about trying to help our community. So you can pull those people in there. Even the librarian, they have resources. All these people have resources that can help you. And believe me, it is no shame to your game to go and ask somebody to help you out, because I do it every day.
Right.
I'll ask anybody for some assistance to get my children the help that I feel as though that they need. And it has worked out for me, because Stacy is a very happy little girl. She's bubbly. She gets into her little mixes every once in a while, but so did we when we were kids. We got into those same little mixes, but Stacy's journey and her siblings' journey is a lot clearer than what it could have been. And she does read. I do have them speaking to other children about different things, and letting them see that just because you're in foster care or you're adopted, it doesn't mean that life is over for you. So Stacy will be continuing to travel through the 52 states and talking to other children about her journey as well, and through the books of future books that will be written in regards to the Stacy F series. So there's so many different programs that are out there that will be able to help families.
Well, you said something right before we took the caller that kind of struck me. You said Stacy was hard to find because you didn't know she was there. And I'm wondering if in our audience there are people who are hearing you that just had the same thought that I did. How does one go about beginning the process of finding out if a relative is in the system and they don't even know?
You can contact your local department. You can start there, and you give the name of the child and the parent. And that's how I started. I contacted the other state because Stacy was in another state. And I continue to contact each jurisdiction, which is called boroughs, from where she was at. And I struck gold. I was able to let them know that this is who the mother is. She does have a history. As a matter of fact, I have the siblings of this child who can possibly be there. And we continued to look and search, and they was able to find her. But they couldn't tell me that this is who she is, because they really didn't know who I was. I could have been anybody.
And I'm thinking that because it's like a HIPAA violation.
Right.
Right?
So yes, it is. It's confidentiality all the way around, mm-hmm. For both parts, for her and for my family as well. But when everything panned out and I did give the right name of who the mother was and told them my relationship to her, and they saw that that's who I actually was, that's when the journey started for me along with Stacy. And it's been a wonderful journey for both of us, for all of us.
Yeah, and I want our listeners to be able to have a chance to like really sit with this information, not just the beauty of the process of the journey and how you've explained it in these books, but because Saturday is National Adoption Day, to really look at and ask them, because I think we get so caught up now, especially with social media, we get so caught up in our own nuclear families that sometimes we're not as cognizant of what's happening with our extended family and our cousins and our relatives. And some of us are doing better than others. And did we check on them? And did we check on their children? Like you said, her mom had a history, so you knew to go looking for other children. And I think about in our community, how many of us know or have friends or relatives that have had histories with drug abuse and substance abuse and different things of that nature. And did we allow any of our very own family members to get lost? We have another caller. Unique is calling. Good evening and welcome to First Edition.
Hi. I was calling in reference to the last call, the speaker, that was talking about some of the agencies that he's experienced working with these families. I have a family that the mother is schizophrenic with seven children, love her children very dearly. and to the point that the children are non-social. You don't take them anywhere. All she do is sit up in her room and look out the window. Call family preservation. I didn't hear back from them for 2 weeks later. And that's the problem that I have with some of these city agencies working with these families, that the rep is like two weeks to a month out, or they're referred to these mom and pop mental health agencies where they'll see the kid or see the adult, supposed to be three times a month for children, six times a month for adults, but then they'll come out once a month, and then when you try to incorporate other services, it's still holding up, this one agency still holding up their medical assistant call. And the parent and the family is not getting help. Now, I have this one agency still holding up. And I have tried to get the parent out the house. I've tried to get the parent to go inpatient. You don't want to go inpatient because what will happen to my children? I'm trying to call around to see if DSS has any type of respite or solitary placement that the child can go to for maybe, the children can go to for maybe 2 weeks. And then it's like all this red tape to get the children back once they come out from inpatient. So she don't want to do that. So how do I help this family?
Well, you are the strongest advocate at this point, from what it sounds like, with this particular family, and to continue to advocate. Some people may not want to go down the direction of getting an attorney to help the family, but you can possibly voluntarily place the children, if there is no relative, to place the children until mom is able to get something together, and she can put things in writing and get it notarized that she's not terminating her rights with her children. I'm not an attorney or anything, but right, this is one of the things that I had to do with some of the relatives that I have. We made an agreement with a nephew of mine's, and his mother wanted to go into a program, and in order for her to go in, she wanted to make sure that he didn't go into care. So she asked me if I was able to take care of him while she continues to get herself together, and we went into
It wasn't even joint custody
or anything. I was able to have her write some papers up and to say that I was voluntarily taking her child while she goes into her program, which was an 18-month program that she had went into. And we went to the Department of Social Services, but we didn't go in there for foster care or adoption, so I didn't receive any subsidies or anything for that. We went because she had an open case with TCA, and that had to change to continue to take for the child. So I was able to take care of the child as the relative resource for the child, and that was many years ago that had happened. So it was easy to go that way.
Thanks. So
the parent doesn't, if the family that I work with, she doesn't have any type of support group,
Ms. Unique,
or family member.
Ms. Unique, because of time, I want you to give your phone number, please, to my producer so we can pass it on to not just Ms. Black Diamond, but also so that we can continue this conversation, try to get you directed towards some services. I'm sorry our time ran out in the segment, but I want to make sure that family gets the resources that they need. And again,
yes,
just say thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Black Diamond's books are available online at, I don't know how to pronounce
Ex-Libris.
this, Ex-Libris, Xlibris.com, as well as Amazon.com. And I look forward to much success for you and having you back here on WEAA.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're listening to First Edition. Stay tuned. We've got one more half hour to go. I'm going to be right here with you, and we're going to be talking about fades and fellows. Good evening and welcome back to First Edition. I am Catalina Bird, sitting in for Sean Yoes, and we are talking with my good buddy, Lamar Darnell Shields, and we'll be joined by Larkus Weber, Director of Programming for Praise. Is Larkus
He's
your director?
He's the director of the show, Phase of Fellowship.
The actual, okay. Hey, Larkus, good evening. Welcome to First Edition.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
And we'll also be joined momentarily by Nelson Mauldin, the legendary longtime barber to Dr. Martin Luther King. Oh, wow. Okay. So, Fades and Fellowship is a theatrical commentary set behind the backdrop of a barbershop that delves deeply into some of the most central issues affecting not only the communities in which the barbershops reside, but also the larger collective consciousness of America. So whose brilliant idea was this?
Yo, hey, my idea. Well, I'm not gonna take, you know, all credit. You know, creator gave it to me, and I just sort of ran with it. But you know, I'm a TED speaker. I've done several TED talks, and what I notice is that there are very few people that look like us who are giving TED talks. Mm. And I think some of the best speakers, and some of the best ministers, and some of the best teachers and educators are men who I've met in local barbershops, not only just where I grew up in Chicago, Baltimore, but all over. And I decided, hey, I would love for these men, in particular men of color, to share their voices and share their stories. And so I was in Montgomery, Alabama one time, and this happens all the time, and Nelson's going to be calling in.
He's here, you know, but we have Nelson now.
So people normally walk into this shop and say, hey, I heard Dr. King's barber cut hair. And then, of course, you walk in the shop, and you see all these amazing pictures. And so I came with this idea along with my art director, great designer from Taharka Brothers Ice Cream, Darius Wilmore. And I said, I would love to do a show here in Baltimore. We did it this summer, sold out at the Reginald Lewis Museum, and we decided to do it again. And so we decided to bring together 13 barbers from throughout Baltimore to share very intimate stories from racism to homophobia to child support issues, everything, politics. And I said, but let's end it with a bang. And so I got in contact with Nelson, and I said, Nelson, I would love for people to know your story, and would you be willing to share it? And so now we have a three-day run here in Baltimore. And so we brought on Mark Laveau and Derek Larkus to serve as the directors. And so we recruited the barbers. Every barber had to audition. They just couldn't sign up because they was cool with me or cool with some other people, but they actually had to audition.
And I appreciate that. And Nelson Mauldin is with us now. And as we stay, and so I think about, so you know I have a son. And
yes.
you know me personally. Nelson
yes.
and Larkus don't. And one thing is that people don't understand why it's so important to me let my dad take my son to the barbershop.
Mm.
And people will say to me, well, Kat, why don't you take him? I say, I feel like it's church for black men.
Yeah.
And it's safe space.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about Luke Cage recently, our kids.
We love
right.
that's we love that
and
show.
So, and that was, what did he call himself? Pop started Switzerland.
Yep,
you know?
Switzerland,
so
safe place.
Historically in our community has this always really been safe space for black
yeah.
men to talk with each other. And I can only, so it's just an amazing thing that you all came together and did this. Mr. Mauldin, I'm imagining that you have lots and lots of stories that you could tell about, and I know you all were on with Sean, and I don't want to be redundant. Tell me where you want this conversation to
well,
go.
Well, Nelson wasn't on because Nelson was stuck in a plane situation,
oh.
so he didn't get a chance to come on the air. It was Larry Lancaster who was a part of the show. But for those who don't know Nelson, I mean, this brother cut King's hair. I mean, they have been friends for years. And I'm going to let Nelson tell the story. But every time I meet someone, Catalina, and I tell them about Faith and Fellowship, and I say, and we have Dr. King's barber, every person's eyebrows go up. He's still alive. He's still this. And just like the movie The Butler, you know, you have the butler, this guy.